Thank you, Brian, and thank you to the Brian and the committee for organising this symposia and for inviting us to speak. A lot of you have talked about biofortification. I'm sort of going to talk about anti-biofortification. So we're purposely trying to lower the content of a trace element as opposed to increasing it. Our work at the U of A, primarily with sort of functional genomics type people, physiologists, and for this work we're partnered with Curtis Posniak's group and University of Saskatchewan. And Curtis's group, they're Durham wheat breeders. They're experts in molecular breeding and genetic analysis. So their mapping work is what I'm presenting, and it's not my forte, so if I gloss over some points, you understand why. Okay. I'm going to state some of the obvious because people have been over this before. Micronutrient malnutrition is recognized as a global problem affecting in the region of 2 to 3 billion people. Deficiencies of essential nutrients such as iron, zinc, and selenium are widespread. And biofortification, the process of increasing nutrient quality of foods, either through conventional breeding or application of biotechnology, is a potential solution to micronutrient malnourishment. And as the previous speakers have mentioned, it's a cost-effective and sustainable approach to increasing micronutrient density in foods. Now, just to borrow Google's corporate mantra, our goal here is to increase micronutrient density of food crops, but we don't want to be evil. We don't want to select for traits that either, in the case where I'm working with, increase the concentration of non-essential toxic elements such as cadmium, or anti-nutritionals such as phytates or some types of polyphenolics, which can inhibit dietary absorption. So clearly we need to focus on traits which allow us to increase micronutrient content, but not at the same time increasing the concentration of non-essential, potentially toxic elements. Now, cadmium in particular poses a particular risk. Cadmium transfer through the food chain, compared to other heavy metals, it really is a serious risk. It's estimated that in non-smoking populations that up to 99% of exposure to cadmium comes via the diet. Now, the reason cadmium is a particular risk is that in soils it's relatively mobile and bioavailable, and plants readily absorb cadmium and transfer it to above-ground portions, including grains. The cadmium content of staple foods is actually of a particular concern because staple foods make up the majority of human diets. Amongst these staple foods, those that contribute the majority of cadmium to diets are rice, wheats, and starchy roots and tubers such as potatoes. Now, among the wheats, Durum wheat, which is the tetraploid macaroni or pasta wheat, if you want to call it that, accumulates high levels relative to, say, bread wheat. But that's not to say that Durum wheats are universally high cadmium accumulators. If you look at populations of Durum wheat cultivars, you typically see it in the range of a threefold variation in cadmium within those populations. Now, our previous work has looked at the genetic basis for this variation in cadmium and Durum wheat, and it's what we've shown is that it's actually a pretty simple trait. It's highly heritable, has a heritability score of 0.8. In fact, low cadmium is easily inherited because it's a dominant trait, so high cadmium is actually recessive. Low cadmium is due to a major QTL on chromosome 5B that contributes up to 80% of genotypic variation, and importantly is specific to cadmium. And interestingly enough, it's actually a historical breeding accident why we ended up with high cadmium wheat in Canada, but maybe elsewhere as well. It was due to selection of genotypes in the distant past, 50s, 60s perhaps, where these lines just happened to be uniformly high cadmium accumulators, and these were the progenitors to almost all of the modern genotypes. But subsequently, now that we know what the trait is, it's actually relatively easy to breed high cadmium out of these populations. In fact, we've already done so. Now, just focusing on CDUB1, which is the title for the QTL responsible for cadmium accumulation in durum wheat, there are a number of properties I want to point out. Not only does CDUB1 regulate cadmium levels in grain, but in fact, it affects cadmium levels in the plant for all life stages and all tissues. So this is a field experiment that I completed a number of years ago, and here we're comparing low and high cadmium accumulating near isogenic lines, which are isogenic except for CDUB1. And you can see clearly that under mature grain in these field trials, that there's about a threefold variation between the low grain types and the high grain types. But if you go back and harvest seedling shoots, literally 3 weeks, not very tall, and analyze those for cadmium, we can see a clear significant difference. It's about a twofold difference here in seedling shoots. And in fact, seedling shoots are in fact a very good indicator of cadmium accumulation levels you're likely to get into mature grain. And I just want to reiterate that CDUB1 is actually a highly specific trait. So this is the same field trial in the mature grain where we've got concentrations of cadmium and mineral nutrients in the high and low near isogenic lines. And we can see that cadmium, again, is different by threefold between the two lines. But if you look at the ratio of the mineral nutrients, the concentrations of mineral nutrients between the high and the low, we can see the ratios between high and low are close to unity for every other mineral. So this is a highly specific trait. So from a biofortification perspective, we can select for low cadmium without any detrimental effect on other properties. And there's no detrimental effect on agronomic properties as well, or performance. So now that we sort of know what CDUB1 is, I started off as a physiologist, so I'm interested in a bunch of physiological questions. When and where does cadmium accumulate in the plant? Are there genotypic differences in cadmium uptake, shoot-to-root transport, and remobilization from leaves to grain during grain filling? And what are the pathways that cadmium transports within the plant? And so we've addressed a number of these things, and I'm only going to show you just a small snippet of that data just to illustrate the key difference. The two pictures there show an experiment where we grew durum wheat hydroponically to maturity. And anyone who's grown plants hydroponically knows that growing plants to maturity for that long is actually a mighty exercise. Anyway, we were most interested in cadmium accumulation during the grain filling period, because obviously this is where it ends up. So if I look at the bottom right first, we can see that we have going from time after anthesis up to 42 days post-anthesis, which under our conditions was pretty close to physiological grain maturity. So obviously at anthesis there's no grain, and then we can see there's an increase in grain biomass during the mid-phase of grain filling, and then it slows again as we approach physiological grain maturity. And this is pretty well correlated with cadmium content accumulation in the same period. So peak accumulation of cadmium occurs in the grain during the peak grain filling period. Not surprising. Interestingly, if you look at cadmium concentrations in the grain, we can see that even at day 7 after anthesis, where there's virtually no biomass in the grain, we already have a twofold difference between high and low types. And that just intensifies during the grain filling period. So even from day 1, or day 7, I guess, we already differ by twofold at least. Okay, so what accounts for this difference in grain accumulation during the grain filling period? And it really just comes down to one thing, and that's partitioning of cadmium between roots and shoots. If we look at the same experiment and we look at whole shoots, for example, we can see from anthesis to 42 days post-anthesis, there's a linear increase in cadmium content in both the high and low lines, showing in red and blue. But even at day 0, so at anthesis, they already differ by that magic twofold or more difference. And then that just intensifies as we go through grain filling. We look at the roots for the same tissues or the same plants. Clearly, we see that we have an opposite effect. The low accumulator has higher concentrations or higher content, I should say, of cadmium in the roots than the high accumulating line. But you also note that there's more cadmium overall in the roots than in the shoots. Now, if we integrate the two data sets and we look at whole plant accumulation, we clearly see that we get this linear uptake of cadmium throughout the grain filling period. But there's no statistical difference between the high and low types in whole plant content. These plants don't, these genotypes don't differ in their capacity to take cadmium up. They differ in their capacity to transport it between roots and shoots. And that's the crux of this CDUB1 QTL. So what we've shown is that retention of cadmium in the roots limits cadmium accumulation in the grain, and it can do this directly, either during transport of cadmium from the roots to the shoots during grain filling, or it regulates the size of cadmium pools, such as cadmium levels in the flag leaf, which may be subsequently remobilized to the grain. So either it's a direct regulation or it's a secondary regulation because it sets the pool size. This led us to hypothesize, and it wasn't just only from this data, that a sequestration of cadmium in the root symplast of the low grain genotypes restricts cadmium translocation to the shoots. Now, it's at this point that I wasted 4 years following dead ends and false positives, because we were at a stage where the genomic resources weren't available. There was no barley genome. There was definitely no wheat genome. So we did a lot of things, and I'm not going to bore you with the stuff that failed, but I'm going to show you what worked eventually. And we've long known that the physiology of cadmium transport to shoots and grain in durum wheat is remarkably similar to rice. So we've long understood that. And in fact, we're aware of the mapping work in rice and some of their candidate genes they were identifying, and we considered them. But it wasn't until these two papers came out pretty much right at the end of 2010, running into 2011, that identified a rice HMA3 as the causal genetic factor regulating cadmium levels in rice grain. And as I'll quote them, rice HMA3 limits translocation of cadmium from roots to above ground tissues by selectively sequestering cadmium into root vacuoles. Now, I didn't make my hypothesis up after reading that. I already had that. So, this is the same thing. Now, if you're not familiar with HMAs as a group, HMAs are heavy metal P1B type ATPase proteins. As a group, they're transmembrane efflux transporters of a variety of transition metals. The larger P-type ATPase superfamily includes proton ATPases, which are critical for electrical potential gradients in plants, and they also include the sodium-potassium ATPases, which are important in animal systems. Now, we were aware that HMA3 was potentially a candidate, but we didn't have the resources at the time, and our genetic mapping was saying, don't do that, don't go there. Rice HMA3 is located on rice chromosome 7. Our earlier mapping work, where CDU or CDUB1 was localized to 5B, we looked at collinearity with rice and with Brachypodium, because that's the tools we had at the time. And the regions are collinear with rice chromosome 3 and Brachypodium chromosome 1. Clearly, rice chromosome 3 is not rice chromosome 7. In fact, there's nothing in this region, this collinear region, which is remotely similar to a metal transporter. So our mapping data was saying, okay, that's not a candidate in our case. But it wasn't until these two papers came out in 2010 that I thought, oh man, I have to ignore the mapping stuff. I'm just going to follow my gut and clone these things. So that's what we did. So we wanted to capture the entire set of HMA3s. So in tetraploids, we're going to have two homeologous copies. In hexaploids, we're going to have three, assuming they're all retained. We used a reasonably novel approach at the time because there was no genome. We first created a composite ABD genomic sequence for wheat or for logs of rice HMA3 using the raw 454 next-gen sequencing that came out in 2012. Now, using this as a scaffold or a template, we went ahead and cloned the entire set of a homeologous set of full-length cDNAs for HMA3 from Triticum tergidum, and this was from a cultivar Strongfield, which is a modern low cadmium type. We also, because we were interested in the entire set, we also cloned full-length cDNAs from Estevum from Chinese Spring, and because we were trying to be encompassing, we also cloned HMA2. This HMA2 set from Chinese Spring, because these are similar similar proteins. Having cloned them, we completed the phylogenetic analysis of the proteins as shown here, and we can clearly see that the wheat HMA3s, which are shown here as red, the triticasia labeled red, brachypodium is green, rice is blue, and arabidopsis is black. We can clearly see that the rice HMA3 proteins are members of the grass clade of the P1B2 ATPase subgroup. Now, within the higher plants, there's three subgroups of HMAs, and the P1B subgroup shows substrate specificity to cadmium, zinc, copper, and lead. At the same time, we've also identified that the three copies actually are located on the chromosome 5B group, which is sort of interesting because that's where CDUB1 is. Not only did we clone them from Chinese spring and strong field, we need to clone these from high and low accumulating types of durum wheat. So we went ahead and did that, and we found that the A copy, there was no difference in the sequence between the HMA3A, so this is the chromosome group A group copy, between high and low types. In fact, there's no difference between that and Chinese spring as well. They're identical. However, when we look at the B copy, we find two alleles. The higher accumulating genotypes have a 17 base pair duplication in the very first exon. Now, the effect of this is that even though the allele for the high types, which is shown as B1B, even though the exon intron structure is retained, the 17 base pair duplication creates a frame shift and obviously a premature stop codon, and we end up with a 16 amino acid translated protein, which is obviously severely truncated. Since it occurs almost immediately after the start codon, we thought we better consider that there might be an alternative reading frame. So the largest single open reading frame, we've called ORF2, is truncated by approximately 500 base pairs at the 5 prime. First, we wanted to develop a DNA marker so we could apply this to our mapping populations. And it was simply a matter of designing primers that flank the insertion and looking for size variation. So we see here on the left, these are parents of our mapping populations, and we can see a size polymorphisms between high lines typified by COFA and then low lines shown by W9262. And this is a sample of our mapping population, double haploid mapping population. Now, so our mapping work has continued from our earlier works, and we continue to saturate the 5B chromosome genetic map. This was from a cross of COFA with W9262. This is the same population we used to prove that CDU was on chromosome 5B. The revised map covers 218 centimorgans with an average distance of 0.5 centimorgans between markers. CDUB1 maps to a 0.7 centimorgan region of 5B, and when we apply HMA3B1, the genetic marker, we see that HMA3 segregates with CDUB1. And they are both strongly associated with grain, a variation of grain concentration. We get a log score of 58 and explains more than 80% of phenotypic variation, which we knew already. To further refine the CDU1 region, we developed a genetic map between the cross of near isogenic lines TLL and TLH. This is the same material I used for the physiological studies. And with a large number of F2 plants, this new mapping interval covers 0.28 centimorgans, and HMA3 maps within a region of 0.1 centimorgans. And I believe that's a pretty close mapping interval. To further characterize this relationship between cadmium levels in plants and association with HMA3, we looked at a diversity panel of 94 cultivars and breeding lines from global collections. And this shows a frequency histogram of cadmium concentration in grains. Of the 94, 92 could be resolved statistically as either high accumulators or low accumulators. And then when we screen those with the HMA3B1 genetic marker, we see this perfect co-segregation of the marker with the phenotypic trait. And we see a typical bimodal distribution, which is typical for single locus populations like this. Similarly, when we looked at 174 Canadian cultivars and advanced breeding lines, we see that we get a sort of asymmetric distribution in this case. And this is a perfect example of how bringing biofortification to the plate, or in this case, anti-biofortification. Because all modern breeding programs have selected for cadmium. So our advanced breeding lines are all low cadmium now. So this is why we get this asymmetry between the two histograms. And again, they segregate perfectly, as is in the case here. Now, clearly the mapping work suggests that HMA3 is a really strong candidate, but we need to do some back it up with some functional analysis. And we've been following two approaches. First involves using yeast as a model test system where we express HMA3B1. Bear with me, I'll be quick. In both cadmium and zinc-sensitive yeast backgrounds, and these are both defective in vacuolar sequestration of cadmium in one case and zinc in the other. We've also been working with expressing these HMA3s in a Arabidopsis background, principally the Columbia one, because Columbia is actually a natural knockout for the Arabidopsis HMA3, so it's a perfect test spin. But I'm just going to present you just the yeast stuff today because the Arabidopsis stuff's not finished. Our yeast assay was based on a real-time growth curve analysis where we grow plants on a 96-well microtiter plate and we literally monitor them every 10 minutes as they grow. We've got, shown in the red, this is the mutants. It's the knockout, so it's sensitive to cadmium because it can't sequester it into the vacuole. We have the parental strain, which is obviously has the native gene. And we also have a positive control where we express the native gene back under the control of our promoter. You can see the positive works well. So we know that the system works. In this case, we've expressed B1A and B1B, ORF1 and ORF2. So this is the original reading frame, and this is the five prime truncated reading frame. And you can clearly see, if we look at the 50 micromolar, we can clearly see that B1A complements this phenotype, suggesting it transports cadmium, where the others two don't. So clearly the B1B is defective. Transport complementing the mutant could be due to sequestration of the vacuole, or it could be efflux from the cytosol back out of the cell. So we need to understand localization. So we've looked at a C-terminal fusion of HMA3 with GFP and expressed them in yeast, and we can clearly see that in the case of B1A, the functional copy, it co-localizes with the tonoplasts in the seed where there's two vacuoles in this case. The very truncated one is localized, we think, within the nucleus, and B1B, the longer alternative reading frame, which we think is somewhat at the periphery of the plasma membrane, and we think actually is still attached in the ER surrounding the nucleus. Okay, so I'm just going to summarize with a couple of figures. So if we just have this table of our different copies of the gene we have, clearly B1B is defective, and B1A localizes to the tonoplast and transports cadmium based on that assay. So if we looked at zinc using the other mutant, in this case I've tested actually all three homologs, A1, B1A, and D1. You have to take my word that B1B is defective for zinc. It is. It doesn't do anything. And we've got the same sort of negative parental and positive controls. If we just look over here, we can see that the empty vector mutant doesn't complement. Obviously, it's sensitive to zinc. And we can see that all of them, A1, B1, and D1, all complement the zinc-sensitive mutant. There is some variation between the three, so there is obviously differences that maybe account for differences in transport. So if we go back to our table, A1, B1, and D1 all transport zinc. Take my word that this one doesn't work as well. Okay, now we've got ourselves in a quandary. We've got CDUB1. We know the phenotype is cadmium-specific, but the gene that underlies it transports cadmium and zinc. And if we fill out the rest of the table, we can quickly resolve what's going on. So I've gone back and looked at cadmium uptake into the YCF backgrounds. This is the cadmium-sensitive one. In this case, we've got A1, B1, and D1 all together. We've discarded the B1B because we know that doesn't work. And if you look quickly over at the end here, you'll see that A1 doesn't complement at all. In fact, it's even hypersensitive relative in the less toxic conditions. Whereas B1 and D1 both complement the phenotype. Now, we know that A1 transports zinc, so it's functional. We also know that A1 also localizes to the tonoplast, so it's a functional protein. It just has specificity against cadmium. Okay, so if we go back to our table, we can quickly summarize what we know and actually help resolve some of the contradictions. So we have a cadmium-specific phenotype in CDUB1, and the reason it's cadmium-specific is if we look at durum wheat, which remember we don't have a D genome copy, we only have A and B, in low cadmium phenotypes we have a functional version of B1A, which transports cadmium and zinc, and a functional version of A1, which transports zinc. However, when we look at high cadmium phenotypes, B1 is completely defective, and we are only left with A1, which transports zinc. So in the high cadmium phenotypes, we still have the ability to sequester zinc in the vacuole, so we don't have any modification of zinc accumulation parameters. So if we didn't have this this genotype for A1, if A1 transports cadmium, we probably wouldn't see B1 at all, even if it was defective. And looking at the slightly larger picture, if we look at hexaploid wheat, now we have a D1 copy, which transports cadmium and zinc. So I conclude that there's actually probably no phenotypic variation in grain concentration associated with CDUB1 in hexaploid, because we have this redundant copy here, and it's likely that all low cadmium phenotypes, it's likely all varieties of hexaploid wheat are low cadmium phenotypes at this locus, which may explain this variation between durum and bread. And I'll just skip the last slide. And that's our funding sources, and I thank you for your attention. Thank you. Criticize that on reviews and manuscripts.
have you looked at any spatial localization of cadmium in the roots?
In the roots? No.
I mean, not in the ones that have the B version, but just in regular roots, have you seen?
No, we haven't. Okay. If I just want to make a comment, funny, the story here was what is B1A doing and B1B doing? It's pretty obvious that B1B is defective. In fact, it doesn't really interest me anymore. Actually, what interests me the most is A1 versus B1. Now, these two proteins are 94% similar at an amino acid level. And we've been working to decipher why A1 can select against cadmium when still transports zinc. And in fact, we've actually answered that question, and we think we can manipulate HMAs such that, especially the HMA2s, which are plasma membrane transporters, which are likely involved in transport of zinc upwards in the plant, we think we can modify them such that they will restrict cadmium transport but enable zinc transport.